Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I'm your host, Todd Embley, and on today's show, we welcome Emmanuel Poupel, WPIC Marketing Technologies Director of Growth for Europe, to explore how European lifestyle and health brands can succeed in China's fast-changing consumer landscape. Originally recorded as a webinar, there were so many incredible insights brought to the discussion, we felt it was well worth publishing as a podcast as well. Drawing on his extensive experience advertising international brands, Emmanuel explains why China's evolving demographics, shifting consumption priorities, and increasing demand for premium lifestyle products have created a major growth opportunity. We discuss why Xiaohongshu, or red, is essential for discovery and influence, how Chinese consumers evaluate value and quality, and why European heritage brands still hold strong appeal. From health supplements and personal care to mental wellness and outdoor products, Emmanuel walks us through the most promising categories and why brands need to lead with storytelling, lifestyle positioning, and an integrated service model to win in China. Enjoy.
If tomorrow we're at the discussion table, virtual or not, and we're talking about how to bring your brand to China, that will be part of the process for us. You know, we'll actually look at the ecosystem and try to contextualize and to understand what is actually going on, whether it's on the services side or consumer, you know, lifestyle or behavior, right? And when you look at some of the projects like Colisée, you understand that there's a demand. You understand that there's an evolving Chinese consumer that has different types of needs, different types of aspirations. And again, if you're in health and European lifestyle, I'm pretty sure now is a very qualitative, opportune time to actually be looking into it, because God knows, maybe you might realize that you have a huge market in front of you.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Emmanuel, welcome, and why don't you give a quick introduction first?
Thanks, Todd. Morning, everyone. Very happy to be here to talk about a topic I'm very passionate about. So I'll start off with a very quick personal introduction. French, grew up in the U.S., which might explain the hard-to-place English accent, I guess. I moved to China after university to study Mandarin in 2005, and I have not really left since. One note on the timing of it until now, just good to keep in mind that China's GDP has gone from 9% of the global GDP to roughly 17% during that period. And numbers aside, for me, what truly matters is the human side of that transformation. And I guess this is what we'll be talking about today. Couple pointers on notes on my personal career in China. So I started in big box retail initially. I then joined JCDecaux, the outdoor media company, which gave us, my team and I, a finger on the pulse of the brand's interest in the China market from 2012 to 2016. In 16, I moved on the brand side and watch and jewelry, including a stint at Chow Tai Fook. For those who know, Chow Tai Fook is China's biggest gold and jewelry player, a pretty sizable company and a great success in China. And since COVID, I basically moved to the service side of the industry and more recently with WPIC, where basically the service that we provide is to operate our partners' brands, businesses, and their brands, obviously, brand management, of course, on the China market. And thanks to what Jacob, Joseph, and the whole team have done this past decade plus, we're also able today to cover Japan and Korea, and we're spreading across Asia, which of course, you know, gives us a stronger relationship with our partners and really enables us to really invest into their business in the region. And One thing that I've come to notice because I just joined the company is how important it is to have a partner that, I'll just say this off the bat, is able to grow quickly with the market. And I think that's pretty key when you are considering China today and given how competitive the market is.
Why don't we cover off the table of contents here? What are we going to be covering during this webinar?
Sure. So there we focused on the why and the what in the title for a very important purpose. Before getting into stats, into specific examples, and given how quickly China is changing, I think it's important to set the stage and to talk about the why and give some context for what's going on in China today. And of course, we'll dive into some specific categories and specific examples to show some of the brands that are actually meeting Chinese consumers' aspirations and wishes and needs.
Okay. Now, to quote everyone's favorite millennial basher, Simon Sinek, it all starts with why. So why this topic today during this period?
So timing, why timing today? We're obviously, you know, right in the middle of the summer. I myself talk about setting the stage for this conversation. I'm right now in the country, in the countryside home, family home in the southwest of France. We're basically at the bottom of the home. The walls are 85 centimeters thick. So I thought this would be a great place to be having this conversation to talk about European lifestyle and brands. And timing of it, well, this is the period when a lot of Europeans and a lot of visitors are basically get to enjoy the European lifestyle. And amongst these visitors, you have a lot of Chinese travelers. I don't even want to call them tourists. They're really traveling. There are tourists, of course, but they're traveling and really discovering Europe. You know, some come regularly, and every time they come, they push the frontier even further. And they're not just going to the Galerie Lafayette today. They're also, you know, seeking out and discovering places in Europe, which maybe 15, 20 years ago, you would not see a lot of Chinese travelers in. And that's not so long ago. So these Chinese travelers are really getting to know Europe today. They're influencers in their own right. Some are highly influential. How influential actually these influencers are, these travelers are, is partially what made Xiaohongshu red what it is today. So it just goes to show how influential they are. And I think it's important to note that these people are basically surrounding us in Europe and getting to see the brands and their products while they're traveling before they go back home to China.
So speaking of China, let's get some more context on what's going on there. Help us understand why this topic is so relevant today.
I'm going to be covering a bunch of topics here that have made the news, of course. Some are a bit more obvious and some may be a bit less obvious. The first one, of course, is Chinese exports. In Europe, in the West in general, we talk about exports from China to other markets. I think it's important to note that most of the brands and the products that are being exported from China, for those that are being sold via through, you know, Chinese brands, Chinese platforms, etc., most of them compete on price. The other thing that I want to note is that when we talk about the Chinese consumers and the consumption, there's obviously a greater emphasis on value for money, for sure. Another thing that I think is particularly important, especially if you haven't, you know, stepped on Chinese soil in the past, I'd say 5 to 6 years, is a change in mindset of the consumer, where I guess before the emphasis was on immediate value, you know, creation and basically getting as wealthy as quickly as possible. Whereas maybe today, particularly thanks to COVID, and this sort of started pre-COVID, but it's certainly accelerating during the COVID years, people, whether business or personal life, they tend to have a much longer sort of timeline in the way that they make decisions, including consumption. And when they think about their consumption and how to spend their time and the money, they're thinking health is becoming a much greater factor, because now that they've amassed, for some of them, a lot of wealth, they basically think about what their purpose was all along. And of course, they want to be able to enjoy it and take care of themselves and their family. Another thing that I wanted to point out, which is sometimes a bit of a shock when I hear the media talk about Chinese consumers is, you know, pre-COVID, Chinese consumers in some cases made up 50% of some of luxury's business globally, of course, whether they were purchasing in China or outside of China, right? These people didn't disappear out of thin air. They didn't vanish, right? Some have a purchasing power which has diminished a little bit. Sure, maybe some are saving, but I think most importantly, they're evolving as they should, as everyone is. And maybe what they were looking for 10, 15 years ago, maybe is a bit different from what they're looking for today. Talk about evolution. We have to talk about demographics, sorry. It's hard to put in perspective what's happening in terms of demographics in China, but it's basically projected that in 2035, 30% of the Chinese population will be more than 60. For the record, that's 400 million people. And all of you know, 400 million people is more than the US population total, right? And there are a few things that we have to point out before we get into some cases later on, is that this generation that was born in the 60s and the 70s, they're really the first generation that is either entering or already in retirement with a real purchasing power. Because this is the generation that, being born in the 60s and the 70s, they were basically entering adulthood, or they already started their career when China opened up. So as China opened up, they're the ones that basically actually benefited, for some of them, the most of China's acceleration. And these people are going to carry that purchasing power through their retirement. Another note on these people, because I find that generation absolutely fascinating in China, is that, you know, when we think about this generation, maybe in the West, we might not necessarily think about a generation which is extremely digital savvy. But actually in China, they are. The primary reason is because we're talking about a generation that basically had to adapt very quickly. We're talking about a generation that went straight from having no phone to cell phone. They skipped landlines, right? And so, you know, their ability to embrace technology is absolutely unbelievable. And so when you think about some of the platforms today, like Douyin, like Kuaishou, a lot of them have amongst their monthly active users or their daily active users even, a lot of the 70-plus consumers who are actually very active and basically use these platforms as their main means for information, but also for purchasing. And so when later on in the conversation, I think this will be something that will be worth keeping in mind. And also another thing that with our colleague Charles in a French podcast we did a couple of months back that we really emphasized on is that today Chinese consumers, 60 plus or just in general, they're not so much looking at whether a brand is from China or from the West. What really matters to them is what the brand does for them, right? And the stories we have to offer to them in terms of lifestyle, right? So I just wanted to emphasize on that point, because I think a lot of times when Western brands are talking about Chinese, they think that Chinese are turning their back towards on Western brands, when actually it's not the case. A couple more things that maybe get talked about a bit less, because of course a lot of the conversation on China is from a Western and Western brands perspective. First and foremost, many Chinese brands are actually struggling to grow their brand equity, right? When we're thinking about Chinese competition in China, it's also very competitive for Chinese brands. It's not just for Western brands. Another thing is that many actors, if you are actually within that ecosystem, you know that a lot of big companies, big groups in consumer and production, they're actually looking to acquire Western brands with heritage. And there's a reason for that. It's because storytelling and heritage matters, whether you're Chinese or whether you're Western, a Western brand, either way. And last point on this, sorry, is that because heritage, you can't just, make it, create it out of thin air. And because China is highly competitive, a lot of the Chinese brands as competitive as they might be in other areas, they found it really hard to build a brand equity, right? So these are some of the characteristics of the market today that I think are very important to keep in mind, both in terms of the market as a whole, the consumers, but also the actual brand's ecosystem, to understand what you're dealing with and plan accordingly.
I want to ask you a question out of left field here. Do you think that the aged population, let's say the over 60 today in China, are more savvy digitally? And I don't mean like using CRM or adopting software, or they use Slack Enterprise within the workplace, or these kinds of things. What I mean is the simple stuff of shopping, of knowing how to use WeChat and e-commerce in general. Maybe they're on Douyin. Do you think that that age population actually adopted and are far more savvy digitally than perhaps in the West? Because I know, you know, my father in his late 70s, if we were to change TV providers and the remote came and it was a different remote and worked differently than the old one, he would struggle.
I think the answer to that question is yes, without, to be very fair to the audience here, having really looked at it in great detail. But just based on my personal experience, I totally agree. I think we have to add another factor here, since we're just spending a bit more time on this topic. Part of that, of the reason for that is how the Chinese government has actually given handed power, and I mean handed. Okay, in China, the Chinese government is in charge. Okay, this is very different from the West, but have handed power to the tech actors, who themselves have basically built super apps, as some people like Elon Musk like to call them, and just in general, which makes it that much easier for these consumers to basically, you know, enter a digital world, which of course is extremely practical. And the families in China, you know, from one generation to another, I guess the relationship's a little bit different. Some all live under the same household. Others share a lot of things in between them. And you have a lot of, you know, situations where you have the grandparents in the Laotia in Chinese, so the home where they grew up. You have maybe the parents who are spending quite a bit of time in another place, and the children sometimes are in between. So they're using these digital tools and these apps to basically, you know, communicate, to, of course, to manage money, wealth, right, for everything related to the groceries, et cetera, at a level where it's almost synonymous with everything that they do in life. And so, you know, on one side, you have consumers from the 60 plus, which came from when China was nothing and had to rapidly, you know, embrace certain technologies. And at the same time, you have a tech world that is absolutely empowered to hand a lot of, you know, convenience and services to them. That combination, of course, is a killer. It's quite unbelievable.
I think that's a really, really good point. In the culture, in China's culture, and we were both there when the smartphone came out in 2007 and, you know, the Android platform came out 2008, I think, with Google Play. And then you watched, you know, basically a billion people get access to the internet that was otherwise prohibitive due to the cost of a laptop or a desktop computer, we should say. Now, how the young are infused into the life of the elderly is very, very different. They are very, very involved, sometimes living in the same house. You know, you can't move out until you're married, these kinds of things. So the young are not only there to help with the adoption and the use for the elderly and solve problems immediately, but they're likely also doing some of the shopping. They are, when they're scrolling, shopping, going through their feed, what their parents need and what their grandparents need is also on their mind. And they will do shopping for that age group as well while they're there, because they're just so heavily involved in their lives. And then you have babies, and then the parents and the grandparents are just always there all the time. I mean, it's a culture that through up and down the demographics are very infused, much more in the West. When then you leave, you go to college, your parents are set. They don't need you. They've got their retirement. They have their 401k. They live on their own. You see them 3-4 times a year. It's very, very different over there. And that makes a difference, I think, when it comes to that digital adoption. It helps it along vastly.
Absolutely.
So why the context matters. Now, thanks for setting the stage. I want to talk about, does it matter specifically for European lifestyle and health brands? And how do European lifestyle and health brands compete?
I think we have to go back to basically what kind of brands we have in Europe, right? And why they're appreciated. And it's true, I think, that a lot of European brands put a huge emphasis on health. And you can sort of put a lot of different things. We'll go through it a little bit later on. And of course, in terms of lifestyle, I talked about the context, the timing, the fact that a lot of visitors are basically enjoying Europe side by side with the Europeans these days. When I talked about the context in China, and I emphasized on the fact that a lot of Chinese brands are competing on price, that value for money matters, and that they don't really care as much as before in terms of whether a brand is Chinese or Western or from wherever, really. What this should tell a brand is that if you're aligned with consumers' aspirations and needs, you should tell your story, right? It's not just about the price. It's not just about being French or Italian or Swedish. The emphasis here is on whether as a brand you bring value, whether it's tangible or intangible, and whether you have the opportunity to tell your story. Now, of course, you need to pick a go-to-market strategy and a partner that actually enables you to tell your story. I'm not going to shock you here. Obviously, here, I'm advocating for what we do at WPSC. The whole model empowers the brand to actually tell their story because we're not just buying products and pushing them to the market. We're making sure that in the process of enabling Chinese consumers and everyone in the ecosystem, whether it's a specific ecosystem or it's just talking about influencers at large, we make sure that the story is understood from their perspective while they're considering or they're discovering the products. And still on the how, there are a few things that really matter today in the context of China and digital and social commerce, right? Digital at large. First is one thing that I think brands still need to do is, of course, pay close attention to traditional e-commerce like Tmall. It's basically your virtual shelf for your products. It's still where a lot of attention is driven from Chinese consumers because Tmall, of course, and JD are platforms which are still very, very relevant today. But brands should also, at the same time, play on social commerce platforms like Red and Douyin, because these platforms are not just driven by search, but they're also driven by experience and the content via live streaming and short videos that enables consumers to discover the brands and the products. And again, it's whether you're Chinese made and designed or European made and designed, it's not really relevant anymore. What is really relevant today is it's all about the brand, the products, of course, but the brand mostly, because that's what enables you to have a premium price positioning, and of course, therefore, lifestyle. That's what the emphasis should be on from day one.
Okay, so now we've covered the why, we have to get into the what and define that playing field. When we say health, what does that really mean?
So for the purpose of this webinar, we wanted to cast a net that was as wide as possible. And I think the one very important point to start with is the fact that we're both talking about the physical and the mental. Mental, historically, in some countries, in some cultures, in some places, may have been a taboo subject. But actually, let's just pick an example, right? Stress relief, as an example, the number of mentions of that term in Chinese, of course, has quadrupled year on year on Red in 2023, thanks to COVID, maybe. But the point is, people are not afraid anymore to talk about these things. And obviously, we have to take that as a win. I think for a culture that maybe at times or in the past for probably very good reasons, maybe did not dare to talk about these things. And it's not just the young today. Older generations as well, I've seen it myself, are much more willing to talk about these things. And I think that's something that a lot of Western brands that I think you know, have put a lot of value on mental health need to keep in mind, particularly in the context of storytelling and how to bring their brand to the Chinese market. The second thing that I wanted to mention here is when we're thinking about health, we're thinking about promoting health. We're thinking about maintaining health. We're thinking about improving health. We're talking about all these things together because when talking about health in general, it should be wide. It should be holistic. It should include all aspects of health in the first place. And for a culture that has, you know, TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, as a hallmark of its culture, I think these are things that speak to consumers as well. And they should be addressed in the way that you bring a brand and products to the market. Moving along, so for the again for the sake of this webinar, there's so many different categories. We basically are using seven categories where we talk about product categories. That is, we have pharmaceutical products, so prescription drugs and OTC, over the counter medication. We have dietary supplements and nutritional products. So that's vitamins, minerals, sports nutrition, plant based products. A lot of different segments under that category. Medical devices, from diagnosis to therapeutic to even wearable health technology, which is becoming very popular these days, which is actually wonderful. Personal care and hygiene products, of course, from oral to skin to hair to body, everything. Feminine hygiene, which we'll cover a little bit later on. Men's grooming, wellness, and baby and child, of course. Fitness and exercise products is the next category, with a lot of different types of brands under that category as a whole. Mental and emotional well-being, of course. And just, you know, going quickly, because there are a lot of categories, and home environmental health products. The one thing I wanted to pause on at this stage might be a bit surprising, but I think it's important to bring it up, is another theme, which is sexual health and intimacy products. It doesn't really fall into one category, but this is something that's getting greater attention from consumers. It's becoming less taboo from the Chinese authority standpoint, maybe a positive outcome of the demographic trends right now. But I think this is something that if Western brands, this is something that they are sensitive about, and this is something that's important to them. It's something that they want to bring as a value to consumers. I think this is a great time to consider this right now for Chinese consumers in the Chinese market.
A quick note, and I'm not saying that there's a lot there, but it is somewhat in parallel with the declining population. And as you've seen, the Chinese government is motivated to try to figure out ways to inspire its citizens to start having more babies. You know, they've started to reduce some of the, you know, housing requirement, the rules, the one child policy, all of that has been walked back tremendously over the last 5-10 years. And then I would think that this would, again, I'm kind of making stuff up here. I'm teasing some parallels that may or may not exist, but I would think that this would be along the same lines or in the same vein of, let's not make it so taboo. Let's help people maybe want to have more and better sex, and maybe we can help the population grow as well. And let's not make it so taboo and whatnot. It might all be kind of helping that along.
Sure.
You want to speak to that?
No. Just I'm the one.
Don't throw yourself under the bus.
It's okay. No. It's okay. I'll be on the bus next to you. I'll be on another bus. Maybe a little bit back. Joking.
Wise.
Look, I think what the way it's got to be looked at is a context, but ultimately, what truly matters is the health of the consumers, and if there are any circumstances that allow for quality conversations that matter to consumers for them to have a healthier life and a healthier lifestyle that present themselves, they must be grabbed and they must be maximized, irrespective of the circumstances and the context. There's so many different things happening that if you spend a lot of time just focusing on that instead of addressing consumers' needs, you can get lost really quickly. For me personally, if I'm a brand that actually helps people have a healthier life sexually and intimacy-wise, and this is the environment I go for it. And I make sure these customers know about me because I want their lives to be improved. For me, that's all that matters, irrespective of how we got here. But I hear you.
Do you think this is more male related? Because I'm just thinking over the last, I would say, let's just even say last year, I'm a member at the local golf course, golf with all the guys there, men's nights regularly, all the things. I've never had more conversations than I have this year ever in my life talking about things like testosterone supplements, taking BCAAs, anti-inflammation, managing cortisol, stress, sleep made, sleep apps that are measuring quality of sleep, creatine, the most studied supplement in the world and its health benefits. I'm very surprised to see that my male counterparts on this planet are starting to open up and be willing to talk about things that could help, which is in a way admitting that maybe they need help, which is surprising.
I cannot really speak on that because here we're talking about Chinese consumers. And I think the how and really diving into specifics really requires a lot of work and attention. What I think I can safely say, irrespective of gender, is that people are more willing to talk about it, I think, in general. And from a policy standpoint, it's much more tolerated because of the context that we mentioned earlier. And so for me, that's a winning combination to invite people, particularly through social media and digital, because it makes reach and targeting so much easier. It is a safe haven for consumers that maybe would not be willing to talk about certain things to be able to. These opportunities should be embraced. And I think a lot of European brands have part of the solution and at least an opportunity to help these consumers.
Let's start breaking down those categories that you mentioned, those the seven that I think you got into. Maybe you could call out a few and talk about which are gaining traction in China.
Sure, sure. Yeah, so obviously, I mean, just listing all seven plus this last thing was took a minute. So we're not going to be able to cover all of them. We picked three categories for the sake of this exercise in this webinar because you know we think they matter and also we wanted to bring up some specific examples. The first one that we're going to really zoom in on is dietary supplements and nutritional products. So on a high level, first and foremost, as you know, so WPSE, we're in the social commerce world. We, you know, we have all the operations to enable brands to access this world across different platforms from the supply chain all the way to the end consumer. We're really focused on e-commerce. And so e-commerce-wise, the market size has grown by 6% in 2024. And if we look at sort of the different trends from one platform to another, Tmall remains the largest marketplace. But both JD and Douyin, by plus 25%, plus 23%, have grown tremendously year on year. So all these platforms are playing a key role when it comes to these products. If we look at segments, there are a few segments that are really accelerating. So fish oils is a big one, about plus 14%, vitamin B plus 27. I probably need more of that. And then amongst functional foods, one that really caught my attention is white kidney bean extract and dietary fiber. There's a technical term for it, which I kind of forgot, sorry. But that one is growing by plus 15%. Point being, it's getting more and more precise. It's getting more and more technical. We're talking about consumers that know what they're doing. And so even if you're niche and you're very specialized in one particular area of these products or functional foods, for example, in particular, we should talk. And one of the clients that I'm going to name two clients here that we have in these categories. The first one is called Fjorda. The name comes from a lake in Norway. Talk about storytelling. It's a premium fish oil supplements brand. We've been working with them for a few years. It basically answers plain and simple, Chinese consumers needs for high quality omega-3 supplements. And we've basically been working with them to develop relevant content and orchestrate influencer collaborations for the past few years. And it has been going absolutely great. Another example, which is quite a different type of brand, it's our Canadian client, New Roots Herbal. New Roots has a very wide range of products. Actually, if you study the brand and you look at what they have, they cover a lot of different areas. But here again, we're talking about storytelling. So, you know, it was very important for them to really make sure that the market understood their brand. And that's basically what we did together. So we worked side by side with them to study the brand's brand assets, understand the story from a Canadian perspective, and then localize it and make sure that we work with the right people to really carry that message forward and make sure that Chinese consumers hear the message and understand the brand before they actually just dive into the product offer. Second category I wanted to talk about is personal care and hygiene products. This category has been pretty big for quite a long time already in China. But maybe the makeup of what makes this category a business, you know, the volume of the business-wise is evolving over time. And some of the segments that are really growing quickly are, say, for example, baby skincare, plus 13%. And that's, as you guys know, primarily thanks to the premiumization of the category. So basically meaning, sure, there are less babies in China. Doesn't mean people are spending less. In fact, when you think about, you know, the average basket is probably growing quite tremendously because, unfortunately, the number of babies is going down quite a bit in recent years. And then men's skincare. And men's skincare, to talk, I was talking about Douyin earlier. It's gone plus 60% on Douyin. And that is thanks to that platform's ability for beauty routines and how to use the products to be on full display, right? Not just a product that is on a virtual shelf, but really showing customers how to actually apply these products. And obviously, men need a little bit of help. I'm the first one that does, who does. Men at large.
Because we're new to it. Help.
Yeah, we're new to it. And it's
you probably haven't used a lot of face creams before or an exfoliating scrub. I don't know how to use that.
Correct. So Douyin's pretty handy, and TikTok as well, the West. One example, if we just pick, I wanted to just pick one example here, but you understand why. Within the personal care category is a female hygiene brand, feminine hygiene brand. Sorry, it's one of the clients that we've had for a few years called Diva Cup. It's a reusable menstrual cup brand. And obviously, if you just look at it as a product, it's a product. But of course, through the brand and through the products, if you really team up with the right spokeswoman for the brand, you can really ensure that a lot of consumers understand how to use it. And therefore, there's a whole educational process that goes through the storytelling. And it matters because it really gives us an opportunity and gives the brand an opportunity to pass on these messages about personal hygiene and health to, you know, themselves, to friends, to their daughters. That's through storytelling. And that's just another example, Diva Cup, of the type of brand that basically we're working closely with and that is actually, you know, benefiting from the Chinese market because they're answering Chinese customers' needs, basically. Last but not least, fitness and exercise products. In 2024, this category grew by 20%. And just want to pause on this because we're talking about 2024 here. I was in China during that period. 2023 was not what was the year where we got out of COVID. So that means that if 2024 grew up by 20%, it means that the post-COVID effect was sustained. It means that it was not just a fluke. It was not just, okay, nobody bought anything because in 2022 you couldn't go outdoors. 2023, obviously, it was an acceleration because 2022 was quite stuck on a lot of fronts. 2024 was only a validation and a confirmation of that trend. Specifically, you have a few categories that obviously are just exploding in the good sense of the word. Cycling gear. Obviously, in China, you know, cycling is part of Chinese culture. Here we're talking about people investing in cycling for different purposes, for health, for, you know, for outdoor, for travel, right? Plus 54% is undescribable as a growth. Quick dry wear, a lot of different brands, are in this space, is plus 42%, and hiking footwear plus 52%. So very clear indication that if you are in the outdoors space, this is a market that is moving and moving very, very quickly. Historically, and I have to mention this because this is one of my ultimate favorite examples, and my ex-colleagues and friends will know already, is Lululemon. Lululemon is an industry reference, including in China, of course, and we're focusing on China here, because they focus on engaging the community and sharing the brand's lifestyle. So they really planted the seeds initially. And it doesn't imply that if you start to do business in China, you need to just, you know, open up a small studio and not sell, you know, any product. That's not the point. But the point is they really made sure that people understood the brand. They started with that and then they accelerated. And a more recent example, obviously not at the scale of Lululemon, because Lululemon is basically on the, you know, a different scale from pretty much any other brand there is out there. But talk about community building and tell your story. One of our clients is called the Spike Ball. Spike Ball is basically a key brand reference in a new lifestyle, which is called Roundnet. If you just presented the products and you put them on a virtual shelf, it doesn't do much for you, right? It's a new concept. It's a new sport or occupation or recreation that you can do with your friends. We actually worked with the brand and with influencers to make sure that in the go-to-market strategy, people get a chance to fully understand what the brand was about. And that's how it got traction. Last but not least, maybe a more classic brand for the world of fitness is a brand called VersaGrips. VersaGrips is, they developed products which are great for weightlifting grips. They're weightlifting grips and wrist straps. So they basically protect this entire part where you're doing weightlifting. Obviously, fitness is booming in China. It's getting huge. People, again, are so much more concerned about their health that they're really investing in it and they're spending time in the gym. So the work that we did with these guys is we really made sure that stakeholders and people in the industry knew of them, understood the products, get a chance to test them out, to showcase themselves using these products. And that was a great way for them to actually accelerate in China and make sure that consumers knew of them so that they could actually purchase them and bring them into their routine, their fitness routine that, you know, they go through a few times a week.
Yeah, those are some amazing brands, all who've entered China successfully, different ways. Spikeball has been great. It's such a small footprint, which I think helps it be more widely adopted, because sometimes in some of those urban areas, space is at a premium. So you don't need a huge footprint to be able to get your friends together and play. I mean, smaller than a little 3-on-3 basketball court, right? Lululemon, founded by a Canadian, actually. Interesting, the guy that founded Lululemon, my gosh, he started a company called West Beach in Vancouver back in the 80s and then sold it off. Did some other things. The guy's a genius at building companies. Okay, here we go. Bonus round and talking beyond products. We're going to talk about services. So going a level deeper, okay? It's not just about the products anymore. How could it be? It's got to have something to do with the service, right?
Correct. And since we're talking about lifestyle and the consumers, obviously, including services in this webinar just felt like it makes sense because it enables you to understand the daily lives and the daily needs of people and also how different types of brands are actually tapping into those needs and aspirations. And I wanted to bring up an example here because I know the head of China, and we had a chance to talk about what they're developing recently, and I thought it was very relevant. It's the French group Colisée, which is a company that operates nursing home facilities and whole care services. Now, of course, we're back to nursing homes, we're back to home care, we're back to people in their 60s and up. We're here mentioning, I'm going to mention here again the fact that this is the first generation that is pre-post-retirement that really has a purchasing power. What I think matters here, what is interesting here, is their new projects, the residences and the communities that they're building. They're not just covering the traditional nursing home facility services or infrastructure. They're looking at health holistically. So they're looking at predictive health solutions, right? So, hey, maybe we can actually anticipate and predict instead of waiting until you're sick to take care of you. We're talking about entertainment and we're talking about comfort. And I thought what he shared with me and some of the new projects in China in this space are absolutely fascinating because they set the stage for a lot of the brands and a lot of the products that we're talking about. This is basically the environment that we're talking about here. And one reason why I want to bring it up, because we're food for thought, right? We're talking about go-to-market. We're talking about strategy. Well, if tomorrow we're at the discussion table, virtual or not, and we're talking about how to bring your brand to China, that will be part of the process for us. You know, we'll actually look at the ecosystem and try to contextualize and to understand what is actually going on, whether it's on the services side or consumer, you know, lifestyle or behavior, right? And when you look at some of the projects like Colisée, you understand that there's a demand. You understand that there's an evolving Chinese consumer that has different types of needs, different types of aspirations. And again, if you're in health and European lifestyle, I'm pretty sure now is a very qualitative, opportune time to actually be looking into it because God knows, maybe you might realize that you have a huge market in front of you.
Let's get to some of the questions that we often get, and I'm going to throw them at you as well. What is the best time of year to launch in China? So talking about timing.
Look, one of the advantages of the marketing calendar in China is that it constantly has opportunities to launch, quote-unquote, assuming, of course, that it's relevant for your brand, right? So you have to make sure of that. You can't just go with automatics without thinking through the relevance of a timing and of a theme, a marketing, how do they call it, festival. You got to be on brand. You got to be relevant. But those opportunities are basically always there. I would say just looking at it from today, right, July, and keeping in mind the importance of the end of the year, so you have Double 11 and then all the way to Chinese New Year. If we were to start a process in the coming weeks or months and try to target that period, it's probably a good time. So that's a very good run-up, runway for launching a brand in China. But really, I don't think there's any particular bad timing, to be honest. I guess that's the benefit of having such a dense, you know, marketing festival calendar in China.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree. I like now. I like yesterday. I think that, you know, with 11/11 coming up, the time to be able to build things out.
Yeah.
I know for sure. Emmanuel does not subscribe to the whole, you know, French, we take all of August off. He'll be working very, very hard for you right through that.
Look at
month.
Me.
Yeah, I know. Here we're talking cellular from his Monte Cristo cell. And then, you know, like you said, 11/11 is right around the corner. Then you get 12/12, which is a little bit more muted these days than it has been in the past. And then you roll right into Chinese New Year. Why not get going now and get everything set up? And if you're lucky enough, you might be able to catch another and be a part of the cohort of the next WPIC accelerator as well. Just another thing to ask about when you get in touch with WPIC. Okay, next question. How important is Xiaohongshu, Red Note, Red, whatever, in your channel mix of what you have to, you know, what you guys are bringing to the table alongside all the other Tmalls and Taobaos and, you know, Douyins and everything?
look, this landscape changes a lot. But for me, that's the importance of red is hard to overstate. For me, red is precisely what a European lifestyle and health brand needs to introduce itself to Chinese consumers, particularly in the context of we're targeting an international Chinese global consumer and the origins of red, which is precisely how it was used initially, which is, you know, these white collar consumers traveling the world and sharing these experiences with their network. So for me, I'm a huge fan of red. I just love what red does in terms of having helped these 10, now it's a decade, I believe. I could be wrong. I hope I'm not mistaken on that. But this decade of just enabling these consumers to be so much more literate when it comes to different cultures and different lifestyles and really have direct access to a lot of quality, just sheer quality when it comes to lifestyle and brands and products. So if you consider yourself a brand that is part of that, you have to be on red. I can't imagine that you would include red in your channel mix. It's impossible for me.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit more. Get this question. And I know that people are asking this, waiting to see if the category that they are in with their brand falls into this or that, which is oversaturated or just getting started. Categories that are oversaturated or just getting started.
Oversaturated. I'd rather have this conversation. I don't know who's asking. I'd rather have this conversation with an individual brand or a person to really dive into that category and understand, because sometimes oversaturation could be simply that it's lost momentum. Doesn't mean that it's not there's no premiumization in play, right? Look at baby skincare, for example. It's still growing despite the fact that the volumes are not going up tremendously, but just people are purchasing at a higher price point.
Or honestly, oversaturation could be a very temporary thing because it's a after effect of tariffs, where there's frankly just too much product sitting that is now being heavily, heavily discounted. And that is not a competitive market. Maybe at the time, you got to wait a few months.
Yeah, sure. Correct. Spot on. There's so much going on these days. I think this is the type of oversaturation, whether a brand is, you know, in a category which is oversaturated, I think is something we need to deal with on a case-to-case basis. One thing is for sure, is very clear, though. There are some categories which are not. So we talked about supplements. We talked about a lot of segments within outdoors. We talked about mental health and, you know, a lot of brands that could be addressing some very, you know, real needs that customers have. Let's have these conversations one by one, because I think that's the way to approach this. It's hard to sort of like paint a broad stroke on, you know, a category or a segment. I would just say that overall, I hope it's been made clear. It's clear today, thanks to this discussion, that health at large is top of mind, so much more important than it ever was from Chinese consumer standpoint. Then, of course, that's theory, or that's at least the market at large. Each brand requires its specific, you know, deep dive, and that's a one-on-one conversation.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all for today's webinar. Thanks to Emmanuel for all the insights.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. If you'd like to speak to Emmanuel or the WPIC team about launching your lifestyle or health brand in China, we'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to reach out. You could just find us everywhere. There's no need to almost have to give you any URLs or anything at this point. You know where to find us all. And if you'd like to get any additional information regarding the different product categories or cases which we were highlighting in this webinar, please do not hesitate to reach out to us as well. So for me, for Emmanuel, for everybody at the WPIC team, thank you very much for joining, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.